October 31st, 2017 marks the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. Dr. Richard Weikart is a professor of history at California State University, Stanislaus, and recently he's made a video that's about 26 minutes long. It's available at YouTube, and all you got to do is just enter the phrase Exploring the Reformation. The full name of the video is Exploring the Reformation and Revivals in Germany. We've had Dr. Weikart on the program before talking about Hitler and Hitler's religion and some of his other books related to that. Dr. Weikart, it's great to have you back on the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Darren.
Sure. Okay, so tell us about this 26-minute video. I think it's really well done. It's exciting.
Yeah, I wanted to do this to commemorate the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, and so I got in touch with a Emmy Award-winning videographer and producer who did all the camera work and the editing and such, because I'm not very into that kind of stuff, but I did all the content and did the narration, and we traveled together this past summer to go to all of the Luther sites and also to Zurich, where Zwingli was the reformer, and then the Anabaptists broke off from him there. And then we also, while we were doing that, I was also have been very interested in subsequent revivals in Germany. In fact, I've been doing some research on a revival in the early 19th century called the Awakening Movement that's not very well known in the United States, but had a profound impact on German religious life, and actually had some impact on Anglo-American Christianity as well. People like George Mueller came out of it, whom maybe you've heard of from Bristol, England. Charles Hodge, the very famous Princeton theologian of the mid to late 19th century, studied under Tolouk, who was one of the guys involved in the Awakening Movement, and then also Philip Schaff, who was one of the most famous church historians of the 19th century in the U.S., had been converted during the Awakening Movement. So I also cover this, these other revival movements, and we traveled to the sites that were related to those too, such as Herrnhut, where the Moravian Brethren were originated and such. So we're really excited about the film, and it seems to have turned out pretty nicely.
Go back to Philip Schaff, if you would. He was a Yale professor, I understand, around the turn of the 20th century, and wrote a multi-volume history of the Christian church and was definitely Christian.
Right.
I hadn't realized he was converted in Germany. That must be his native home?
Yeah.
Or was?
Yes, he was born in, he was actually born in Switzerland.
Oh.
And then as a young boy, he was orphaned, and then he was sent to Korntal, which is one of the places we filmed. We filmed in Korntal. He went to Korntal, where he went to school at it was a Pietist community, and he had a conversion experience while he was in Korntal. And then after that, he went to study I think he studied at the University of Halle for a while, or Kalkin, but I know he studied at the University of Berlin under Neander, who was a key figure in the Awakening Movement in Berlin. Neander was a church historian. He was really the most prominent church historian in Germany in the early 19th century. So Schaff studied under him. And
wait, is this the same as Neander, as in Neanderthal? It's Neander's Valley? No. Oh, okay.
Totally different.
No. There was a genuine Christian fellow named Joachim Neander.
Yes, he was earlier. He was a couple centuries earlier.
Okay, sorry. All right, go on.
But yes, there was a Neander about two centuries earlier who was a hymn writer and very prominent German religious figure. That's correct. But no, this is a different fellow. This is an early 19th century professor of church history. So no, it wasn't connected to Neanderthal.
But here's the thing that's so fascinating about this is that Luther's movement, as you point out in the film, it spawned so much Christian activity initially, and then a lot of that, I guess, went into other countries. In the meanwhile, and this part I hadn't known about, were those subsequent revivals, ultimately it could be tied back to the Reformation, that took place in Germany and produced a lot of great fruit. And let's talk also about the Protestant deaconesses, which was something, a pre-nursing type movement that ended up being very important for Florence Nightingale. And I think, it's interesting.
Yeah, this is a very fascinating part of the story, too. One of the things that I feature in the film is a number of charitable organizations that were founded. There were some founded during the Pietist movement. August Hermann Franke founded an orphanage that blossomed into a huge school complex. He founded a mission society, a Bible society, and all sorts of other things as well. But then that was in the Pietist movement in the late 17th and early 18th centuries. But then a century later, in the early 19th century, the Awakening movement spawned also a number of charitable organizations. One of them was this deaconess institution that you're mentioning here. And it was founded by Theodor Fliedner in the city of Kaiserswerth, which is right next door to Düsseldorf. It's actually a suburb of Düsseldorf today. It's on along the Rhine River. And he set up this deaconess organization as a way to find ways of ministry for young single women. Nursing was one of the big ways that they promoted this. So he set up a nursing school, essentially. But it was more than that. It was a place to train women to have Christian character, to be able to do Christian ministry through their nursing. And Florence Nightingale visited there once before she actually went there to study. She actually studied nursing there herself.
Wow.
And then also supported the work there.
Yes, as if you don't mind my mentioning it, but Dr. Kennedy and I wrote a book called What If Jesus Had Never Been Born, in the chapter on healthcare and the incredible impact of Christianity on healthcare. Florence Nightingale, whose theology wasn't, fully orthodox and so forth, but she was absolutely positively influenced by Christianity when she decided essentially create, the practice of nursing and so forth. She had two main prototypes to work with: Protestant deaconesses and, of course, Catholic nuns. And, from that was, sort of the origins of nursing. So hearing about that tie, I thought that was absolutely fascinating in your video.
Yeah, and orphanages as well. I mean, the notion of orphanages a lot of times do also go back to either monastic communities earlier on,
yes,
in the Catholic tradition or in the Protestant tradition. Very often they were motivated by Christian charity and love. And when these times of revivals took place, like the Pietist movement in the late 17th and early 18th centuries, and then the Awakening movement that I covered there in the early 19th century, there was just an incredible interest in promoting charitable activities and setting up orphanages and schools and places to feed the poor and to help those who are sick. And so all of these things were very important parts of these revival movements. So it was really Christianity in action. And in fact, the person who founded the Pietist movement, or was considered sort of the founding father of the Pietist movement, was a Lutheran pastor named Philipp Jakob Spener. And we film in the documentary, we actually have some film of his church in Berlin. Was his last church that he was there, but he actually founded it when he was in Frankfurt earlier on. But he wrote a book called Pia Desideria, and in that book, one of the things that he stressed very heavily was the need for Christians to be active in their faith. That he wasn't teaching that faith, that the works would save you. He was definitely upholding Luther's idea about salvation by faith, by grace alone, through faith alone.
Mm-hmm.
But he said that faith alone should be motivating us to do good works. And so he focused on getting people involved in charitable activities.
In the film, obviously Luther and the 500th anniversary is the touchstone for the whole thing. And you actually showed the Wittenberg Cathedral, where Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses on October 31st, 1517, which sparked the whole Reformation. You also show the castle where he was holed up, and he translated the German Bible, and he revolutionized the language. And it's a really well-done project, and I commend you for it.
Yeah, thanks. We really had a great time traveling in those places, too. And because this is the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, there were special exhibits on display at some of those museums that we went to. And so we were able to film at the Luther House Museum in Wittenberg, which is really special. They had a really wonderful display about Luther there. The Luther House is the place that actually had been the Augustinian monastery in Wittenberg when Luther first came there. But then he was given it as a house once the monastery was dissolved and all the monks had left. So the Elector Frederick, the Wise of Saxony, gave him that house, and now it's a museum. It's the largest. It's the largest exhibition of Luther memorabilia and artifacts and documents and such in the world. Naturally, but also at the Wartburg Castle that you mentioned, the castle where Luther went in 1521 after he was declared a an outlaw of the empire and had to go into hiding, essentially. He was there incognito at this castle at Wartburg, which is a fantastic castle. If you ever get to Germany, Wartburg is really one of my favorite castles. And I've been to a lot of different castles in Germany. The Wartburg Castle is rich history. Luther was there for about 10 months or so. He translated the New Testament while he was there. And so they still have the Luther Stube, as they call it, a Luther room, where Luther actually did that translation work. And they have a desk and Bible there. We have that on. You can see that in the documentary there, too, which is really neat.
So you go on YouTube.com and then put in the words "exploring the Reformation." So now,
make sure you look at the 26-minute version, because we do have a trailer up.
Oh, okay, a 10 minutes. Yeah,
a minute.
Yeah.
You might have a minute and a half trailer. There's also a 10-minute segment too that they did of the first segment of it. But if you want to see the whole thing, it's a 26-minute thing. So
yeah, it's well worth the time. I've seen it a couple times now, actually. Good job. All right, so I've got to ask you this, since I've interviewed you so many times, you know, related to Hitler, the Nazis, and all that. What happened? Here's the birthplace of the Reformation in the 1500s. Then by the 1900s, you once told me something on this radio program. I asked you, you know, how sizable was the evangelical population in pre-Nazi Germany? And you said it was actually very marginal. It was a very small population by that time, unfortunately, you know, despite all these different reformations and revivals that you've talked about in this film.
Yeah, of the three revival movements that I cover, the Reformation and then the Pietist Revival and then the Awakening Movement, the Awakening Movement was in the early 19th century. And interestingly, the Awakening Movement was already responding to widespread Enlightenment rationalism, which had crept into the churches and really was dominant before 1816 when the Awakening Movement broke out. So the Enlightenment had already pretty much taken over the churches before 1816, before the Awakening Movement. And so most of the pastors and theologians in Germany, even by the early 1800s, didn't believe in miracles, didn't believe that Jesus had risen from the dead, didn't believe, you know, they basically were preaching to sort of a morality and didn't believe in the distinctives of Christianity already by that time. Now, the Awakening Movement did turn that back to some degree, but they never really won over most of the theological faculties. They did. The University of Halle actually did get a contingent of people from the Awakening Movement, and I do talk about the University of Halle in the film. August Tolup was one of the leading figures but there were some other theologians that came and joined him on that faculty as well. But even there, he faced persecution when he first went there. So he was a representative of the Awakening Movement. When he first went to the University of Halle, he actually faced persecution. There actually were riots around his house when he first went there by people who were opposing the Awakening Movement. And at many of the other universities, they really didn't win over the theological faculty. So after the Awakening Movement started to die down by the 1830s and 1840s, I mean, it still was having impacts beyond that by people who had been converted and were still carrying on their ministries. But really, the excitement and enthusiasm was sort of ebbing by 1840s, certainly the theological faculties were continuing on their liberal trajectory, so that by the late 19th century, the vast majority of the German church was once again back in the thralls of liberalism.
Wow. Can you go on longer, Dr. Weikert, this program? Okay, good. Because there's so much to discover in this. So what happened then was that basically you had theological liberalism in the seminaries undermining belief in the Bible, and that ultimately is what led to Nazi Germany, and that's why so many of these people, you know, fell away, even if they were outwardly professing, you know, some kind of churchianity or something?
Well, I would say it didn't lead to it in the sense that it necessarily had to produce, you know, something like Nazism, but I think it opened the door in the sense that it didn't provide any reason or rationale to oppose Nazism or whatever the latest thing was that sort of came along. So theological liberals in the late 19th century and then on into the early 20th century were basically pretty much willing to accept whatever the, you know, secular intellectuals believed was the truth. So Darwinism comes along, and of course Darwinism is true, you know, the theological liberals would say, and we'll just integrate it into our beliefs, you know, because they didn't believe in the Bible anyway as being inspired word of God or infallible in any kind of way. And so when nationalism comes along, they can incorporate that into their ideas. Scientific racism comes along, they can incorporate that into their theology. Eugenics comes along, they can incorporate that into their thinking. So I mean, they just sort of would buy into whatever the latest progressive ideas were out there in the secular, among the secular intellectual elites. They would just, you know, put that into their theology and incorporate it there. So it didn't give them, they didn't have any firm biblical foundation to stand against and say, wait a minute, you know, this isn't true. You know, scientific racism isn't true because God created all men equally. And, you know, we have this biblical foundation to go back to. So they didn't have that any longer. So they eroded that. So when Hitler came on the scene, he actually did win a lot more votes from the Protestant parts of Germany than he did from the Catholic parts of Germany, because the Catholics were a little bit more conservative in certain kinds of ways and a little bit less susceptible to Hitler's rhetoric.
No, I have to ask you about Martin Luther and anti-Semitism, because sometimes he's brought up as if that's his only, you know, legacy, which is a very, you know, obviously unfortunate part of him. But how about your comment on him and that?
Yes. Yeah. Late in his life, Luther wrote a pamphlet that was very strongly against the Jews and promoted burning down their synagogues, driving them out of the land. He did not, however, advocate killing them. In fact, he specifically said they shouldn't exercise violence specifically against the Jews. He wanted to drive them out of the land. Now, my own perspective is, I think that one of the things that led to this, and that was really a problematic area in Luther's thinking and practice that was going to help produce this anti-Jewish screed, was his accepting of the state church idea. When Luther broke away from Catholicism and established Lutheranism in Saxony, and then in other states in Germany began, because Germany was not one country, it was a bunch of different states and principalities. And
it was a part of the Holy Roman Empire, I believe.
Correct. And parts of the Holy Roman Emperor was Catholic and was wanting to maintain everything as Catholic, but was unable to keep all the other princes in line in that respect. But when all these other places started breaking away to Lutheranism, they basically established Lutheranism as a state church in each of these different principalities. And so if the ruler happened to converted to Lutheranism, then his whole realm would go Lutheran, and Catholicism was not allowed in Lutheran lands, nor was any other expression of Christianity. So what you had was this system where Luther was basically just taking over the Catholic notion of a state church and implementing that, but with different doctrines. Now, the problem with that is then that obviously doesn't leave any room for any kind of religious toleration. And so, and in fact, I should say, too, that the Calvinists also did that to some degree as well. I mean, in Geneva, you basically had to adhere to the Reformed faith, or you were banished or whatever, you know, banished, or in case of Servetus, he was even executed, but usually banished from the lands. So Luther, seeing the Jews, and early in his career, Luther had actually made positive comments about the Jews and hoping that they would be converted and different things like that. And his hope was, in fact, all along that they would ultimately be converted. But if they wouldn't convert, then finally, toward the end of his life, he said, we ought to drive them out of the land. But that was actually what they were doing to everyone else of every other religious persuasion, too. It wasn't just the Jews that they were picking on. The Anabaptists also, for example, were enemies in many of these lands. And the Anabaptists also were forced to leave the Lutheran lands, as well as the Reformed lands of Switzerland.
But by the way, the Anabaptists would be people like the Mennonites, the Amish, that kind
That's
of
right.
group. Okay.
Yeah,
and a lot of them went over to the United States.
Believer's baptism, yeah.
I'm sorry?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, after you.
The Anabaptists were the people that practiced believer's baptism.
Right. So, okay. And they were, unfortunately, they were persecuted as well. As far as the book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, which I read, by the way, word for word by William Shire, he does kind of imply one could read into it the idea that you know, Hitler got some of his anti-Jewish thoughts or ideas from Luther. That seems to be an overstatement. But what are your comments on that, as a scholar?
It's totally wrong. Actually, there were other people in Germany that may have got some anti-Semitic ideas from Luther, or at least that used Luther as a justification for it. But Hitler was not one of those. I have I wrote my book Hitler's Religion that came out in 2016, and I studied Hitler's religious ideas extensively. Hitler never mentions Luther as a source of his anti-Semitism. He mentions Schopenhauer as a source of his anti-Semitism, never Luther. And Hitler grew up as a Catholic. He wasn't a Lutheran. So he wouldn't, as a young child, he wouldn't have been exposed to a lot of Luther stuff in Austria, for example. And he sort of dropped out of even the Catholic scene, was pretty anti-Catholic, too. So the notion that he got his anti-Semitism from Luther is completely wrong. Again, there may be some Germans that did, and certainly Germans used that as a justification for their anti-Semitism, which was a horrible thing in that time. And we know that they did. In fact, there was a group called the German Christian Movement that arose in the late 1920s, early 1930s, that was sort of a Nazified form of Christianity, if you want to call it that. But it actually was a very liberal theologically as well. But they sort of used Luther in that kind of way. But Hitler himself did not.
And isn't it true that most of the opposition, I mean, honestly, especially by 1944, against Hitler, including those who tried to take his life and so forth, they were professing Christians of one version or another, and so there was a lot of opposition from the church against Hitler and the Nazis.
Yes, there was. The two main groups of opposition were the far political left, like the communists and such, but then also those who were more conservative in their theology, or even neo-Orthodox. The neo-Orthodox persuasion of Karl Barth, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and others, they also stood up against the Nazis. So yes, there were quite a number of people. The White Rose Movement, which maybe you've heard of, was a young people's movement at the University of Munich. There was a movie that just came out about Sophie Scholl just a few years ago, who was part of that White Rose Movement. They were basically opposing Hitler for on the basis of Christian convictions and because of what they saw his murderous campaign in the East. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, there were a number of people that stood up to Hitler based on their Christian convictions, especially those that did happen to be more conservative theologically.
At one point early on when Hitler was becoming very popular in Germany, did he liken himself to Luther in the sense of, hey, there hasn't been somebody this popular in Germany since the days of Martin Luther?
I don't remember him making that comment. I mean, it's always possible.
But even if he did, it wouldn't matter because Luther gained his fame or whatever notoriety in a totally different type of context. Is there any? Yeah, go ahead.
Hitler did make clear in the Mein Kampf that he did not see himself as a religious reformer. He actually makes that comment. He talks about being a religious reformer. He says that we are not about being a religious reformer. He says if someone else wants to do that, they can do that, but we're going to be a political movement.
Yeah, and now when people take the one famous statement from Mein Kampf where he says, basically he says something like, we're going to, fight against the Jews because that's the Lord's work or something to that effect. And you've pointed out in previous discussions, Hitler's religion was essentially nature with a capital N. How about you elaborate on that and mention that quote from Mein Kampf, if you would?
Yeah, that quote is actually one of the more famous quotes of Hitler, where he talks about by dealing with the Jews, I am doing the work of the Lord. But what people a lot of times don't look at is the sentence immediately above that, where he had talked about nature's will and how those that transgress nature's commands, are going to be visited with. I forgot exactly how it's phrased there, but in any case, he's personifying nature and even deifying nature in the sentence immediately in front of it. And he also calls nature eternal in that passage. And if nature is eternal, then nature is not a creation of some other god that's bringing it into existence. So he saw nature as being an eternal thing, and he saw nature itself as being what humans should worship. And so this brings us a far, far piece away from Luther. By the way, getting back to the Luther connection,
yes.
There's one huge difference between Luther's kind of opposition to the Jews and Hitler's, and that is that Luther wanted to convert the Jews to Christianity. That was his solution to what he saw as the Jewish problem. Now, again, we can lament the way that Luther wanted to destroy their property, destroy their synagogues and such. I mean, I think that's horrific, and I am not excusing Luther for that at all. But Luther was wanting them to convert to Christianity, and if they did convert, he was willing to let them stay. Hitler thought that their conversion to Christianity was the worst thing that could happen, because that would then bring in what he saw as their bad biological heredity into the German people, and that would then corrupt the German biological traits and such. So Hitler saw it as being a hereditary problem, a biological problem. Luther saw it as a religious issue.
Hitler was committed to an evolutionary worldview.
Clearly, he continually talked about the struggle for existence between races, and that the superior race needed to exterminate the inferior races. And he thought that his project was to try to sort of help that process along. And so that's why I argue in one of my books in my book Hitler's Ethic, especially, although in my other books as well. But in Hitler's Ethic, I argued that Hitler was embracing evolutionary ethics because he thought that evolution defined what was good. Good morally, and so he was going to sort of help nature along.
And From Darwin to Hitler, I think, is the first book that I was aware of that you wrote. And in fact, your website, FromDarwinToHitler.com, has more information on that. We have about 3 minutes remaining, and let me go ahead and recap the top story here that we began this discussion with. There's this great new video out that is available at youtube.com. Richard Weikart made this. Weikart, by the way, is spelled Weikart. And if you just look for Exploring the Reformation, just those words, Exploring the Reformation and Revivals in Germany, look for the 26-minute version. And in fact, here is the very opening of Dr. Weikart in that very film.
It's 2017, and here we are in Wittenberg, Luther's city, celebrating the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, an event that was going to dramatically change all of world history. Hi, I'm Richard Weikart, professor of history at California State University, Stanislaus. Please join me as we explore the religious dynamic of the Reformation and other religious revivals in Germany over the past several centuries, which were going to change the lives of multitudes of people, which were going to get people reading the Bible, and which were going to result in a new zeal for missions as well.
We have just a couple minutes left. How about just a quick comment, just a panoramic view on why is the Reformation important? What's the positive impact of the Reformation?
Yeah, well, in making this documentary, I was wanting to feature the Reformation and these two subsequent revivals as times when God moved in powerful ways to restore proper doctrine, such as the notion of salvation by grace alone, through faith alone, and the supremacy of scriptures, but then also to sort of stir people up to think about the religious excitement and dynamism that was up in these movements, the charitable organizations that came out of them and such, so that we could hopefully think about how we can sort of re-energize Christianity today.
Okay, very good. Any last thought about the importance of how the kind of the rediscovery of the Bible, if you will, through the Reformation? Getting it into the layman's language?
It was fundamental. And in these revival movements that I look at, the Pietist and the Awakening movement, and by the way, this is true, too, in the Wesleyan revivals, the Methodist revivals in England. This is going to be true in the American revivals that were going to take place in the 19th century as well, and the 20th century for that matter. I mean, the Bible is fundamental, the notion that the supremacy of the Bible and sort of getting back to primitive Christianity. This is a constant theme in revivals. They're going to come wave after wave over the centuries after Luther's time.
All right, Dr. Richard Weikart, thank you so much for your time. Again, Exploring the Reformation and Revivals in Germany. If you go to YouTube.com, just look for Exploring the Reformation. Those words will do it. 26-minute version, look for that. And also, you can look at FromHitlerToDarwin.com. Dr. Weikart, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us on Vocal Point.
Thanks for having me on, Jerry.
All right, thank you now. Bye-bye.